Nick Wright is joining me. Get Nick Wright's Twitter account. Co-host First Things First, my buddy Nick Wright here on our Saturday podcast. You know, I was just laughing at some of these people that are telling me, I've been doing this now 30 years, so I'm pretty good at selecting topics and, you know, this is what we do for a living, right?
Yep.
I love everybody telling me, you are not talking about the China NBA story. And my takeaway is, did I go to the trades and ask for a producer? Does everybody get that China NBA is a bureaucracy-laden story about a government that would not make a great topic for a sports talk radio show? I am amazed at how many, the fake outrage crowd, who wants me to talk, they don't really care about China. And by the way, if they did, they wouldn't have their iPhone because their iPhone was made in China. So they're complicit supporting an evil government, I guess. All of our iPhone, as they tweet about China from their iPhones that are from China. But when people say to you, why are you not breaking down this fascinating NBA China story? What would your take be?
Well, it is so rife with hypocrisy. I mean, you just pick the layer you want at it. First of all, the Venn diagram of people demanding that we crush the NBA for the human rights atrocities in China, and the Venn diagram of combined with the Venn diagram of people who scream, keep politics out of my sports coverage, it's not even a Venn diagram. It's just one big circle. It's the same group of people who don't want you to talk about anything but the games if you're discussing social injustice in this country or racial inequality, but are then demanding it because they deeply care about sweatshops in China or the horrific internment camps that the Uyghur community, the Muslims in some parts of China are going through, or what's going on in Hong Kong. They are only using it as a cudgel to try to silence black people. And so I think it is almost impossible to participate in daily modern life without making some basic, you know, moral, I don't want to say equivalencies, that's not the right word, but moral bargains. The iPhone,
right, right,
where your shoes are made. Like, we all basically decide, there's only been one person my entire life I've actually known who refused to buy anything that wasn't American made. Happened to be my father. I mean, he was a union guy forever. When my parents split up, we looked for a television for his house for 9 hours. Because you know how hard it is, even 20 years ago, to find a TV that was made in America? The vast majority of us always make these kind of compromises.
Yes.
And yet, listen, the NBA, and if you really want to crush the league because they have chosen economics over universal, you know, equal rights and over human rights globally, feel free. Like, I understand that's a legitimate stance to hold, and I get it. They value the relationship with China, but it is the same type of compromise we make all the time, and I just doubt that these people actually really care.
They don't.
I just think they don't like, and I'm going to say one other thing. I think it is totally legitimate for people to say, I am deeply educated, deeply concerned, deeply involved in injustices that are happening in my hometown or my home country, and I am not as invested in geopolitical and international issues. I think you can say, for example, let's say someone's biggest issue is the oppression of the protesters in Hong Kong. I don't think that therefore means they have to be deeply invested in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Like, you're allowed to say these are my issues and these aren't my issues. And it just, to me, it's obvious hypocrisy from folks that, by the way, when they're attacking the NBA for the relationship with China, they seem to very leave out, when the politicians do it, attacking a guy I know relatively well, Tillman Fertitta, the owner of the Rockets, because he is a loud and adamant political supporter of a president they like a lot. And so the hypocrisies go. Ted Cruz goes after Mark Cuban, not Tillman Fertitta. And I think it's pretty obvious why.
Yeah, I mean, I think this idea that people deeply care. If you're a farmer and your subsidy is cut, you have a right to be mad. If you're a senior and your pharmacy bill doubles, you have a right to be mad. If you're a renter and your lease is doubled, those are personal things that you should complain about. None, zero of the people bitching about China and the NBA care about the NBA or China. They don't. So I use this line with my daughter. Don't let people with no life ruin yours. People that complain, to complain about stuff they don't really care about, are simply lonely, angry, miserable people. If you want to complain about something that deeply affects your family, I've got your back. I've totally got your back. The guy that rips the NBA, go to his last 200 tweets about the NBA. They're all negative. So,
I'll take it a step further, because what it used to be when the NBA athletes, vast majority black athletes, would talk about police brutality and police violence, they would get, people would immediately go to the same charlatans, either what about Chicago, meaning violence in Chicago, or the red herring of black on black crime. Basically, what are you doing in your own community? And now that over the last few years, NBA players have become some of not only the most charitable, but some of the most activist athletes in American history, addressing real issues in their own communities, building schools, providing opportunity, those things. That arrow has now been removed from the quiver. So now it's, why aren't you solving a century-old dictatorship? Why isn't that? And it's just, again, I think one could make the argument that the entire world would be better if we were more of a global community and we cared about human rights violations everywhere. But that is not how America has ever operated. And we've never asked celebrities, in order to have any cause domestically, you must therefore be invested in every cause globally. So to me, it is just so transparent that it is, to me, using real pain and suffering of various groups of people in China as just a cudgel to try to silence black people from expressing their dissatisfaction with what's happening locally or domestically in this country. And like you're saying, the people tweeting to you about it, saying, why aren't you talking about China? If you started doing that type of show where you talked about every, nuanced geopolitical or somewhat domestically political issue, they would hate you for it. They would absolutely be furious. It's the same people saying, keep politics, or sports are my escape. I don't see Black Lives Matter on the court. Why aren't you talking about China? It's just obvious what they're doing to me.
Yeah, I mean, listen, people tell me to stick to sports. Then they want me to talk about China.
Right.
Well, that's bureaucracy. I've been doing this for 30 years. I'm really good at it. This is what I do. I talk. I know how to produce a show. The guy that's lamenting my lack of China talk, it has no interest in China. He's got an iPhone from China. He's then complicit assisting an evil government. And if you really care about human rights, you just don't care about young basketball player human rights. You care about all human rights in China. So I'm pretty much over it. I do think this is one thing both sides. I'm kind of fascinated by this because I do think of myself as a kind of a social left, fiscal right, is that both sides do this. Conservatives look at me and say, oh, you now are just very woke, as if I just am inauthentic, to which I would say I was pro-gay marriage before Obama and Clinton. I've been pro-gay pot or pro-pot forever, pro-gay marriage forever. Yeah, pro-gay pot. That would be a fascinating platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, that could be a good business.
Yeah. But the idea that you're just doing it, but I think Democrats do it to conservatives, where they're like, you're just trying to get clicks. No, I work with Jason Whitlock. He's conservative. I don't have to agree with him. I don't think he's making it up. You're more liberal. I don't think you're making it up. The idea that everybody's just playing a game, conservatives claim, now I'm getting a lot of these. That is very woke. I was pro-gay marriage on the air in Portland 30 years ago.
That word to me, Colin, it's one of the many phrases like swag or woke that actually originated in the black community and then all of a sudden was kind of taken by a totally different community to mean something totally different. Like, I'll go on a slight non sequitur here, but since we're kind of on the political topic anyway, sure. Like, 4 years ago, when the term fake news came about, it had a very specific meaning. It was news, mostly on the internet, made to look like it came from a credible source, usually a small local newspaper, and the entire thing was made up. It was news that was made to look believable to dupe the audience into thinking, wow, the Des Moines Register reported this. That's the origin of the fake news term. It then got reclaimed or claimed, and now you have athletes, coaches, politicians, any story that someone doesn't like, they just call fake news, and the word has lost all meaning. What's happened with the term woke, which is essentially now just weaponized to mean you are showing empathy or care for something. I can't imagine you actually do care about it. Therefore, I think you're virtue signaling or any of these things. The reason people, I think, throw that term around so often is because for a lot of folks, it is they can't comprehend that some people might actually be able to have empathy for others who are dealing with things they aren't. And so if you express outrage, you know, on your show, and you talk less politics than basically any sports show in America, but if you just, you know, if you, the days after the George Floyd protests, if you talk about that for 5 minutes and how affected you were by it and how, even though that hadn't been your life experience, how scary you understand it is for other people, some people, I think it is so, their brain is wired in a way that because they can't feel that type of empathy, they think no one can.
Yeah, no, I think.
And
that,
so you
yeah.
must be faking it.
Yes.
So you must be putting on an act to try to get attaboys from the liberal media, as opposed to, no, man, I felt sick to my stomach seeing that, and it made me sad. Like, I think some people don't believe that emotion is possible.
You know, it's interesting. My wife and I have this discussion. I've said this before. I love Bill Maher. Don't agree with him all the time, but love him. And I've also read an Ann Coulter book. My kids like hip-hop. My wife likes hip-hop, but we sing country music at home because it just puts it in a good mood. There's a certain duality. I can like a bunch of stuff. I have no problem. Now, I see you, Nick Wright, joining me, and I see to myself, this is a pretty left-leaning guy. Are there times, though, similar to me, that you do listen to the other side and feel like, you know what, it's a fascinating perspective?
Well, I think there are plenty of instances in my lifetime where the folks on, you know, the right, because with the perspective of time, you can look back and say, oh, that was one I think they got right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's the concern that I'll use a very, I think, localized example, but I think this is kind of one of the foundational principles of some types of conservatism, at least what it once was, is, man, there's too much red tape. If I want to open a barbershop in Kansas City, the amounts of licenses and fees and hoops I have to jump through is onerous. And that type of, you know what I mean, over-regulation or government bureaucracy, I absolutely want to listen to those conversations. And I would argue that once upon a time, what was considered conservative tax positions, I think, are actually quite smart. Now, we've got to go back maybe 50 years, but there's a lot of things that I think are, it's very, very few, as you said, on the social issues. There's almost, I'm exceedingly far left on social
but,
issues.
But Bill Maher brings up something that I think is a fair criticism of the left. And he says, conservatives will come on my show and argue with me. He goes, liberals won't go on conservative shows. He goes, I can invite any conservative on, Ben Shapiro, Bannon. He goes, they're like, all right, can't wait to argue. He said there is something redeemable about the willingness to spar. And I do think, and that's one of the reasons I love Bill Maher's show, he gets into these occasional little feisty arguments, and I feel like as a consumer, Nick, I'm learning stuff.
Well, I think so, and I've said this to you before, because I used to be a every single episode watcher of Mara's show, not as much anymore, and this is not a fault of his, but what has, to me, in a very unfortunate way over the last, call it 5 years, deteriorated as far as our ability to have big conversations about important topics is our inability to agree on a set of facts. And so, like, Mara's show, and I think I'm just using him as an example, but a lot of these shows, I think it used to be, okay, here are the facts. You know, the left thinks we should address it this way. The right thinks we should address it this way. Let's debate it. And I find that really interesting, really stimulating. And as you were saying, sometimes I find myself saying, oh, I actually agree with the person I didn't think I was going to agree with. But it's so often deteriorated to we are actually arguing over what the set of facts are, which I've made this joke to you before, I think off the air. But if we debated sports the way we debated politics, it would be none of the shows would work because I'd go on with you and say, you know why LeBron's better than Jordan? Because LeBron's got 8 rings. Jordan only had 3. And you'd say, wait, I watched it. Jordan won 6. LeBron, no. Look it up. Check it. We can check after the show. LeBron's got 8. Jordan's got 3. So how's it even an argument? Like, you, at least with sports, we all agree the Lakers beat the Clippers last night. We can debate why it happened. And I see, by the way, you're doing a very good job avoiding that hurtful topic for you. But with we all agree on almost the rules of the game, what happened and then we debate why it happened. And I hope, because it does seem like, and people have different explanations for this, but it certainly seems like starting around 2010 people started doing politics a little bit more like sports teams, which was, I have to root for my team no matter what, even if I think they're wrong. I remember listening to you, I think it was pre-FS1, and the timeline probably had to be, where you said, listen, I voted for Obama. I'm happy he won. But everyone's got to acknowledge the Affordable Care Act website is a disaster. It's his big thing. And they totally butchered the rollout of it. Yeah. And I think once upon a time, it was not considered sacrilegious to say, hey, dang, my side screwed up on something.
Right.
But now people are so entrenched and so almost, you know, hunkered down that a lot of people feel a desperate need no matter what to defend their side, even if their side is doing something they disagree with.
What's up, everybody? John Middlecoff, 3 and Out Podcast. That's me. That's the show. Go subscribe right now wherever you listen to podcasts. You like Colin's show, you'll like mine. I talk football, and more football. Coming up this week, Bill Belichick, his biggest challenge yet, Joey Bosa, huge money, NFL quarterback feud. We dive deep into it and much more. 3 and Out Podcast. Go subscribe right now.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think we have a bit of a – Bill O'Reilly was on this like 15 years ago. A little bit of a culture war. I think there's some people that have been marginalized. Rural American poor. They shout boycott NASCAR and boycott baseball. Boycott the NBA. They kneeled. And I think boycott Nike, boycott this and that. And the reality is – what has really happened to me, it used to be that if I owned a farm and you worked on the farm, I made more than you, but not 7,000 times more. Silicon Valley and the wealth has really separated America. And the truth is, it has made even the middle class virtually powerless. Virtually
and
powerless.
And almost non-existent.
Yes.
It's very, yes. I mean, you know,
I guess my point is, what it's done to even the middle class, they feel weakened. There's fear with that. There's anger with that. And I understand that. I am not mocking them. If I have 3 kids and I'm being replaced by a robot or some techie kid and I'm a 58-year-old manager and I lose my job, Nobody wants to hire me. And I think what you're getting, this anger is fear-based. Silicon Valley is largely the exponential wealth generated over a day has separated the coasts often from the Midwest, the burbs from rural America. And I think there's real fear out there. Not that it's justified, but I understand it, because when society pulls away from you and you feel like you're being left behind, that stirs a lot of understandable emotions.
Well, and listen, I mean, that's the old, like, economic anxiety argument, right? And so I think it's what's been made pretty clear over the last however many years in this country is there is a non-negligible portion of the country. I don't know what percentage it is, but it is it's not 1 in 100. There's a percentage of people who race is the single most important thing in their life. And that they, and whether that's fear or hatred or whatever it is, that is going to be their guiding star. Set those people aside. There is another group of people who I think you are talking about who feels like what I was promised via the American dream was a lie, which was that I didn't have to be, you know, a master's in business in order to build a decent life for my family and put a kid or two through school and have a decent house in a decent neighborhood. And I think that black, white, Hispanic, for people of all colors, that's something that now, you know me, I'm a union guy. I think the lack of some of the public sector unions has hurt that. I think obviously the technology has, while it maybe has helped society as a whole or obviously has, there's a lot of folks you can't go from. I worked in a factory for 26 years, so now I'm going to be a coder. You weren't trained for that. And so there is an element of folks who feel like I did what I was told to do. You know what I mean? I went to school. I finished high school. Maybe I got a bachelor's degree. Maybe I went to trade school. And I went and learned a craft, learned a trade. And I thought I was supposed to be able to do this for 35 years, set enough money aside, have my house paid off to put a kid through a good public college and be able to retire. And it's like, no, actually, turns out your job's gone. And you're probably going to have to work till you're dead. And for a lot of those folks, I understand why they would be furious with everybody. Yeah. Now, I think a lot of that anger gets misdirected and they get tricked into thinking it's, you know, folks coming in from Mexico they should blame and stupid stuff like that. But yeah, there has been a drastic shift as far as what rich means, as far as, you know, and how many people classify as super wealthy and how many people classify as middle class, which I don't like. It's called middle class, but it's certainly not like a middle quadrant of our society. It's an incredibly shrinking amount of people who are like, no, I'm comfortable. I'm not wealthy, but I'm comfortable. Those people are, you know, few and far between these days.
Yeah. Nick Wright, co-host First Things First. We did an Instagram Live this week, and I will say we fumbled around with it for a few seconds, but appeared to have mastered the platform.
Clearly.
I got to tell you a funny story. My daughter, 3 months ago, says, Dad, TikTok's interesting. She said, don't you think it's kind of funny? It's the only platform on social media that takes all my information. She had a term for it. She's very techie. She goes, it's made in China. And then she added a couple other layers to it with the pandemic. And she said, do you think it's possible TikTok was created to monitor American citizens? And I said, God, I have no idea. I said, where did you read that? And she said, well, I didn't. She says, but it's the only device on social media that takes blankety blank information from me. And then about 2 months later, I read on the internet and I read it and I thought, oh my God, what? And there were people echoing her sentiments.
Yeah.
And I'm moving into this.
Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Mike Pompeo's worried about that.
So it's, I don't know if my daughter got it somewhere or not, but of all the platforms on the new platforms in our 20 years of doing this for a business, your favorite and why, and the one you just don't get and why?
So Twitter to me has been the best and the worst in that it's been the best in that I don't I used to have to go to like Sports by Brooks and The Big Lead and Deadspin and all these different websites to try to find some stuff to see what is going on other than the biggest stories. Now I just scroll my Twitter feed because I'm following, you know, the accounts I need to, and I get all the latest news immediately. I'm never behind on anything. It's the worst in that it has absolutely become a compulsion. If I am 2 hours behind the news, even if it could be Friday evening and I don't have a show until Monday, I feel naked. Like, I feel like I have to know what's happening at every single moment. And I don't think that's healthy. I think it's bad for my brain. Like, I wake up and the very first thing I do is see, like, check Twitter, not my mentions, but just check Twitter to see what's going on. It's the last thing I do before bed. So I don't think that's been good for me. Like, just kind of like human development. I can't, when I'm on vacation, if I don't delete the app from my phone, I'm scrolling it all the time. Like, so it has hooks. It's got its hooks into me. Now, it has been good as far as I think one of the reasons that FS1 hired me, or at least gave me a look, was I was a local host in Houston, but I had 40,000 Twitter followers, which for a local radio host in Houston was like a significant amount. So, you know, it allows you to put stuff out there. So that part's good. The one that I have not, I never got on any of the picture-based ones or video-based ones. So Instagram, Snapchat, and TikTok, I don't have an account. Snapchat, I never really had an account. Instagram, I'm trying to build up because it does seem like it is kind of the wave of the future, but maybe TikTok is. But TikTok is confused. Like, I feel like an old man on this.
Yes.
TikTok's confusing, man. And, like, my kids love it. Like, it is, you know, my daughter who's just turned 15, or I guess not, she's 15. Like, she's been on TikTok forever, back when it was called Musical.ly, which is what it once was called before it switched over to TikTok. And I do see, it seems like a lot of these, like, viral stories of, like, the, you know, the different Karens in public and stuff, it's, like, always recorded on TikTok.
Yeah.
So I guess people are using it. But I feel so far behind, and I know it's dumb because you should just start up. But I also feel like, man, am I going to start from scratch on a whole new social media platform? But I wish I had done that with Instagram 5 years ago instead of starting an Instagram 2 years ago, because I'd be further ahead. But Twitter is sports media way, way overestimates how many people in the public are on Twitter. But in sports media, all of us are on it. So it's just, you got to kind of, like, to me, Twitter's the one I use more than anything. I don't use Facebook at all, and I'm getting into Instagram more and more. I think it's probably similar with you.
Yeah, I mean, you can, to be honest, most of these platforms you can't monetize. I get 330 million views a year on Facebook. My company doesn't make any money to noteworthy on it. I mean, YouTube channel's where the money's at. If you have a good YouTube channel, my company makes a lot on my YouTube channel, a lot. But most of these, I find Twitter is where I get my information, and I view it as a marketing platform. I send out my best stuff for my funniest lines, and I think it's almost like it's the old icing on the cake. It's not the cake, but it can, if you take a really smart edited rant, put it on there. It gets a lot of attention, and it's good branding. It gets your name out there.
I think you nailed it, though, on the YouTube thing, which is, I mean, there are some of the wealthiest people in entertainment media these days are folks that don't have a TV show, don't have a radio show, but they have a YouTube channel with 8 million subscribers. And they're 20-something-year-olds who just, you know, made $9 million last year. The number of people who, and I'm not trying to act like I'm a super popular guy, but among the people who stop me and say, I watch you, I would say half of them say, I watch you on YouTube.
Yeah.
Like, that, as opposed to, and those are the people, by the way, who very often when they see me, and some, like, they know me, but their friend doesn't, I'll hear them say, oh, yeah, he's on ESPN. Or he, like, they, because they don't watch on FS1, they watch on the internet. they watch on YouTube, and so they probably follow me and you and Max and, you know, whomever. And so to them, we're basically all on the same network. You know what I mean? We're all, we're just sports media guys. But the YouTube thing, the amount of money that is made by YouTube, and another one that I haven't ever got into because I'm not a gamer like that, is Twitch. The folks that live stream them playing video games, there's a ton of money in that too. But I just feel like an old man on this stuff. I'm like, I'm on the radio and on television. Like, that's how you can consume me.
Okay, we're going to play 20 questions, except I'm going to ask two or three. Nick Wright's worst habit.
Oh, smoking. I mean, I have worn nicotine patches for 13 years. Since I met my wife, I started wearing level one nicotine patches. You're supposed to wear them for 6 weeks maximum. I've worn them for 13 years. And yet, as you saw yesterday, get a couple tequilas in me, and I'm still going to rip a black and mild like my life depended on it. So, I mean, some would say gambling, but I look at gambling not as a bad habit. I look at gambling as something I really enjoy that at times, you know, I make a lot of money. At times, I lose some money. But my philosophy on gambling has always been I just have to you got to know how much money you have and so how much money you can play with. And so I don't look at gambling as a bad habit. Smoking is an unredeemable bad habit I have. I just love black and milds. There's just nothing I can do.
Movie you love, movie or TV show you love that has been critically mocked or panned.
Oh, that's interesting. So
Tom Cruise was in a movie called Cocktail that I liked.
Well, it's so funny you say Tom Cruise. I don't know if these were critically mocked or panned, but I've watched all of the Mission Impossible
movies.
Except for maybe Mission Impossible 2. Mission Impossible's 3, 4, 5,
yes!
and 6 are four of the greatest films ever made. And my wife makes fun of me all the time because I bought them, like I own them on Amazon Prime, and all just basically, almost every night, I'll put on one of the Mission Impossibles and watch. And she'll be like, why can't you just turn the TV off and go to bed? And I need the TV on to help fall asleep, but if it's something I haven't seen, I stay up. So I've rewatched Mission Impossible 5 7 minutes at a time, probably 20 times. So I love those movies. I love the Bourne movies. I love the Mission Impossible movies. I think those things are great. I think they're great, not movies, great films and pieces of art. And I will die on that wall.
Yeah. Finally, electric chair meal, one to go. It's...
Oh, okay. So I'm going to have some type of steak. So it's probably going to be... if it's my last meal, either a Kansas City strip, like you were so kind to cook when we watched Lakers Clippers, or I guess, you know, in theory, I want to leave as much money as possible to my family, but I can spring for the A5 Wagyu, basically uncooked. So I'm doing that. I'm going to do cream spinach. I'm probably also going to do sauteed spinach. I'm going to do some type of beefsteak, tomato, onion, blue cheese, gorgonzola salad, and I'm going to have a big glass of good tequila and no dessert. I'm not a dessert guy.
I know you're not.
Maybe a slice of cheesecake, but I had that A5 $30 an ounce Wagyu steak. Kendrick Perkins lost a bet to me about the NBA playoffs last year, and he had to pay for a meal of mine. And so I think you're supposed to get 6 ounces max of that. I got 18 ounces of A5 Wagyu at Del Frisco's in New York City, so which was $540 Kendrick Perkins was paying for it, so I didn't care. Now, I will tell America this. That is not a steak, I think, that is made to be eaten in that quantity. Because it was, while it was maybe the most delicious meal I've ever had.
Very marbly.
It is so marbly and it is so rich that I don't think your body is conditioned to take it, but it was worth it. So, yeah, I think that's my electric chair meal. By the way, also, if I get to pick the meal, if I also can pick the form of execution, I would much prefer firing squad than any of the other. I think that's
really?
The best way to go.
Yeah.
Electric chair seems horrible. The injection, I feel like they screw up. Just firing squad, I feel like just go is the best way to go. I think that's my take.
Yeah, the electric chair. I don't even like when my shoes rub on a carpet and I get shot.
Yeah, that's no good. It's no good.
It's not really good. All right. His name is Nick Wright. Saturday podcast. That is enough. I have thoroughly enjoyed the last couple of days hanging with Nick, my friend. Have a great weekend.
You too as well. Thanks for having me on, Colin. Talk to you later.